The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition this week. We're on show number 3 in a series where we're discussing kind of our approach to asset management, which we talk extensively and have for years about our retirement planning process and everything related to that. We've done asset management for pretty much just as long as the retirement planning side, maybe longer, honestly. But we don't talk about that a whole lot, so we've been kind of telling people how we have progressed or evolved, might be a better word, over time with our approach and preferences for how assets are managed for retirees specifically. Remember, we are focused on those in the distribution phase of their lives for the most part, or close to it at least, some of that transitional phase, maybe in your 50s, getting ready to retire. But we're not really, you know, designing systems and procedures for those in the accumulation phase down in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. We're going to continue on today. We're not going to repeat everything that we did before. We'll continue on today with show number 3 in this series. We've already talked a bit about the background and history of our thought process on this. And now we're going to get into exactly how we do it, kind of like a couple years ago when we talked exactly how we do our retirement planning process. We'll get into the asset management, how we do it, and then how we have chosen to structure our fees for this service. I think it's a bit unique. I haven't run into anybody who does it exactly like we do it. There's more and more doing it this style, if you will. But I'll grab Jim here. Jim's joining us from the remote studio. So welcome back, Jim.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be back. It's cold as heck out there today, though. Have you been outside?
Yeah, single digits. I've been trying to stay inside, but it was certainly not fun getting in my cold truck this morning.
No, I stayed inside, of course. My hot water heater decided to spring a leak this weekend, so it's always perfect timing.
Oh, awesome, yeah.
on a weekend where you can't get a plumber to save your life unless you want to pay 16 times the normal price, at the beginning of a massive cold snap. It's just perfect timing. I love how life works out that way. But anyways, got a plumber here just a little while ago, and he confirmed it's leaking. I was like, yeah, I kind of thought so when you see the water coming out.
But better question is, does he have a solution for it?
Well, he liked my suggestion. I think we need a new one.
Oh, yeah.
Which nowadays, I mean, as everybody knows, you can't get one. And he giggled. He's like, well, I'll see when I can get us one. So he's going to get back to me and see when he can get that put in. So what I've been doing is emptying it. Mm-hmm. And then when I need to shower, I time it right. So I'll fill it because the leak is relatively slow. It's just been going on for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And it got a lot of things wet, but not to the point where I need to hire, you know, that blue van, green van people to come dry it out. So I fill it. do my laundry, do my dishes, take a shower, hook up a hose, drain it, and start over again. So it's just been a royal pain in the you know what. Anyways, enough about that little bit of whining. Yeah, today we're going to continue. I think this is part three. We're going to get a little bit into some specificity, especially regarding how. We covered the why. Now we're going to cover the how. And unlike Chris, our retirement plan, which the how I think was about three parts, the how on the investment management side, I think it's just going to be one part. I don't really see this going into another podcast beyond what we're about to go over today, because how we do it is quite straightforward and simple and truly could be mimicked by anybody out there. It's not difficult. And we specifically came up with a term for this. Did we not, Chris? When we started doing this, when I started coming up with this and reviewing it with you, I told you, I'm going to start calling these by a certain name, our asset management service. Because when you stop to think about it, that's truly what it is. What am I getting at, Chris? And lead our listeners down that road a little bit of how we view our asset management service.
Well, we view it as a convenience to those who want to offload that effort or that chore, if you will. We deal with a lot of do-it-yourselfers who have managed their own assets maybe the entire time they've been accumulating, or they had advice at some point, have decided to do it on their own or started on their own and actually have a professional doing it for them. We kind of deal with all these, but a ton of our clients are actually what we call do-it-yourselfers. But just because you've been a do-it-yourselfer, you know, mowing your own lawn, that doesn't mean you necessarily want to do it forever. Plus, you might prefer the way we mow the lawn, if you will. So we kind of provide this service to those folks that prefer the way we do it, maybe, or are just tired of doing it themselves or would like to have someone else handling it for them. One less thing to worry about in retirement. And so we've, you know, you coined the phrase convenience portfolios or term convenience portfolios, because that's really what they are. They're not, as you mentioned, designed to be exotic, fancy, you know, do all kinds of crazy things that a person couldn't do on their own. I joke all the time with people I talk to about our asset management that honestly, we're not going to claim that we can do anything that you can't. You absolutely could do what we do. And maybe you're already doing something very similar to what we would do with your assets. It's just a matter of, hey, would you like us to mow your lawn now instead of you having to have that chore? That's really where, you know, we're coming from here. We're not trying to say that you've got to do it with us because we're going to be better than you're doing it or better than someone else you might hire to do it. One thing I can say that the way we do it is probably more understandable, easy to follow compared to a lot of methods that are out there. And what that leads to beyond just the understandability of the process, which we find is important as people age through retirement, having a overall plan, including the management of their assets, that's easy to follow for them and maybe beneficiaries or a spouse that's really not into it. Maybe only one spouse was the do-it-yourself investor and the other spouse isn't that interested. And maybe they become the only spouse, you know, the only person at some point if the do-it-yourselfer passes first. We've got to, you know, have that understandable nature to this process. And by keeping it straightforward and understandable, it also allows us to do it very efficiently and at, you know, relatively low cost, which can be an advantage as well. We're big fans of keeping costs as low as possible to achieve the desired result. So, you know, that's kind of where we're coming from in all this. And I really do like your phrase, and everybody I've mentioned it to, you know, kind of giggles at it because they like it too. It puts a smile on their face, the convenience portfolios idea.
Okay, perfect. And that's something that I wanted to make sure we went over with our listeners. Not again to work with us. This is not meant to be an infomercial. I hope you listeners are gathering from it and learning from it. One of the things we always say and have been saying on this podcast from the get-go, and the reason I know we say it, is It's my podcast. It's our firm, Chris. It's something we drill into the heads of our clients all the time. And I say, don't look at your retirement through the eyes of someone today. Look at it through the eyes of someone tomorrow. Don't look at it through the eyes of the younger you. Look at it through the eyes of the older you. Imagine yourself in your retirement in your 70s, 80s, and maybe even 90s. We mentioned on the previous two podcasts, part of the reason I evolved from an active management to a passive management strategy was, well, there's many reasons. Go listen to those podcasts. But part of the reasoning was also I wanted simplicity. I wanted the ability to pass on to a second spouse who may not be as active with investing if the first spouse who is active passes away. Or I wanted something, Chris, that would be easier for an agent under a power of attorney or a child beneficiary who's trying to step in and help an aged parent. Understand quickly and easily what's going on, why we own what we own, why the client might own what they own. So you need to be thinking of that too, you do-it-yourselfers, as you manage your own money. Look at your future, not where you are today. You may not understand everything that is going on. So that's part of the reason I went to a passive approach. And a passive approach can be easily modeled, if you will, in target risk portfolios, which we'll go over in a second. But that's how I came up with the concept. Chris also mentioned this, and I want to reiterate. The approach that we're going to talk to you about how we do things now, yes, we freely admit you can go out there and do it yourself. You hire us, it's going to be for a convenience. You're going to say, hey, what are you going to charge me, guys? And we're going to do fees on another show. What are you going to charge me for doing this? And you're going to decide, well, I could do it myself. Or should I pay them to do it? Might be a heck of a lot easier to have them. I see what they're doing. That's going to be a decision you need to make, certainly not us to make. It's one reason we have specifically separated financial planning fees from investment management fees. We believe firmly investment management is not financial planning. Financial planning is not investment management. They're conflated. They're kissing cousins, as I call them, but they are not the same thing. So we separate out and we try to have as transparent fees as possible. If you are doing it yourself and you're thinking of hiring someone, make sure you understand how you're going to get those services or pay for those services. Are they all rolled into one? Is investment management part of financial planning? In other words, you don't get financial planning unless you bring your pool of money over and they're going to charge you to manage your money and quote unquote give you financial planning. These are some of the things you have to look for. Okay. The other thing that I want to point out as we start going through this, we received an email, Chris. So I guess we're going to pause quickly. We received an email last week that I want to get to specifically on this series of EDUs. And I made an assumption that most of the listeners knew the difference between active and passive management, but apparently that's not the case. So we received an email. Hi, Jim. Thanks for the great information you and Chris provide. I have a question about your recent EDU series. You keep using the terms active and passive management, but I'm not sure the context in which you are using these terms. Mm-hmm. Does active management refer to the assets under management financial advisor who is buying and selling assets? Those assets could be individual stocks. They could be index funds. They may even be actively managed mutual funds. Or do you mean active management by referring to the actual investments themselves, that they are either actively managed or in index funds? It seems if you have an advisor who is investing in actively managed funds and is an active manager, you would get hit twice in management fees. You seem to be conflating these two concepts. I wonder if you could provide a distinction.
I think this person, the way you described it, I think they know the difference. They're just kind of drilling down a little farther. But I think we should address, for those people who may not be clear on it, the fact that, you know, active management and passive management are two different approaches to managing assets or investments. And there's believers in both and the benefits of both. But active management, essentially, you're looking to beat or outperform through your own individual investment selections some market or benchmark, if you will. Where passive management, you're just looking to mimic or perform substantially similar to a particular market or index itself. And you might think, well, why wouldn't I want to outperform? Well, it's harder than it sounds. It's been shown. There is some evidence that some people can outperform. But when you factor in the cost of the efforts to outperform, then it gets a lot murkier. And you're just as likely to underperform as overperform or outperform. So in our favored approach, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong in your mindset on this, Jim, but I think we're fairly aligned on this, that the thing that you can do for sure is keep fees low. And that is definitely keeping dollars in your pocket. So that's a more reliable thing. And it turns out that passive is also more straightforward and simplistic or simple to follow. So there's advantages there. So in our quest to keep costs low for folks and take a straightforward approach, and the fact that there isn't clear evidence on how you can reliably find outperformance via active management, that's how we ended up on the passive side. So I guess there's that kind of that higher level. Now, you can take what he's talking about, which is, and he nailed it on the head, if you've got an active advisor who's working for you, who's picking and choosing, trying to outperform, and then he's using tools that are also actively managed, you've got fee layers upon fee layers there, and that makes it even harder to overcome those fees with potential outperformance. So I think that's what he was focusing on. I think he knows the difference. I could tell from the way he's talking about it. He understands the difference. But he was curious about the breakdown between those two levels of active management.
I agree. So thank you for picking up on that. And what I want to let this listener and all listeners know, he is 100% correct, and as is Chris, as usual, with how I was approaching this. I wasn't conflating them in my mind. I wasn't explaining it well on the podcast. But he is correct. There is going to be the investments themselves, which he pointed out could be individual equities, could be individual exchange-traded funds, could be individual mutual funds. I'll go ahead and throw in individual bonds as well. So he is correct. There's all these different types of investments themselves. Those investments, especially the ETFs, Chris, and the mutual funds, can be actively managed or passively managed. A passively managed ETF or mutual fund generally will follow a benchmark or an index, is generally very low fee structure on it. All you Vanguardians know what I'm talking about. Very, very low fee structure. You could also have actively managed mutual funds and exchange-traded funds. Actively managed ETFs or exchange-traded funds are relatively new to the ETF landscape. The SEC had to pass a few special rules before ETFs would start doing it. But there's more and more. I recently read an article. I say recently. It was last year sometime, Chris. But one of the fastest growing categories in the exchange traded realm, if you will, are actively managed ETFs. Mm-hmm. A lot of the mutual fund providers who would not give ETFs because they're active managers are now starting to come out with their own ETF version, Chris, of a lot of their actively managed mutual funds. Mm-hmm. So you can have actively managed ETFs and actively managed mutual funds. So the listener is correct. There are two layers when I say active or passive. There's the investments themselves can be active or passive. As a firm, I have moved from previously using active mutual funds to now almost exclusively using passive exchange-traded funds, not active exchange-traded funds. I will say we are looking at a few active ETFs. We have not began adopting them, but there's a few that intrigue me, if you will. So there is the active and passive on the actual investment side, but there's also active and passive on the investment management side if you're hiring an advisor. So when you are paying an advisor, whether it's a AUM fee, assets under management fee, where the industry standard, again, is 1%, but it can go as high as 2.25%. And Chris, you and I have seen, we have seen a lot of large firms, especially, charging 1.3%, 1.4%, 1.5%. So not everyone charges 1%. And we have seen also a lot of advisory firms charging less than 1%. Mm-hmm. But the industry average, they say, is 1%. So you could have a manager that you have to cover their fee, the investment advisor fee, not the investments, but their fee. And those advisors will have two approaches. They may say to you, we are a passive advisor or we are an active advisor. In other words, they may design model portfolios like we do. We design model portfolios designed specifically to track certain target risk benchmarks. So I would categorize our firm, Chris, as a passive asset manager using passively managed investments.
Yeah, that's a great way to you know, cover both bases, essentially, because this listener was right. There's kind of those two layers that could be either passive or active. I will say, just to also, for people who aren't real familiar with this, clarify a bit more that on the passive side, that doesn't mean it's not watched, monitored, due diligence done, adjustments made, things like that, but they're not for purposes of trying to beat the index or beat the market. That's the difference. There's certain things that must be done with a portfolio for proper general rational managemented, you know, practices, if you will, rebalancing, coordinating for distribution. So there's things done with the portfolio. It's not a put money in and hold it for 20 years, never looking at it again. It's not that level of passive. So I just wanted to clarify that. It doesn't mean I don't want people to interpret passive as, oh, they're not even paying attention to it. It's not that at all.
Oh, no, we're going to get into that when we describe how we do things with our convenience portfolios.
Right.
So I just wanted to clarify, I'm not conflating the two and interchanging them. In my mind, I knew what I was saying, but I never really described this to our listeners. So I'm trying to point it out. And the listener is correct. You could have an active investment manager helping you, an active planner helping you. In other words, he or she may be actively looking at your portfolio. It's what I used to do, folks. I was an active and an active manager in the past. I actively manage the portfolios and utilize active investments inside them. But I would sometimes, not sometimes, but I would sit there as part of what we offered at the time. And we would try to say, okay, well, this year or right now, interest rates are going up. So we're going to reduce this fixed income and maybe add that fixed income. And, oh, look, there might be war in Europe. We're going to go higher on oil or energy stocks right now because we feel they're going to be better. That's an active investment manager. He or she is trying to take all the data around them. On paper, it sounds brilliant. In practice, it doesn't work too well because you got to be right so many times. But they kind of look around at everything going on in the world and say, okay, because of this and that, we're going to make this change. And because of that, we're going to make the other change. That is how an active investment manager does things. Now, an active investment manager can still use passively managed investments.
Yep.
So it doesn't mean you're passive and passive or active and active. You can be an active manager, but use passive ETFs. And that is one of the biggest categories of advisors today, Chris, because it allows those active managers to lower one segment of their fees, the fees clients are paying on the investments themselves. So a lot of active investment advisors use passive exchange-traded funds. Again, years ago, I freely admitted I was active and active. Now I'm passive and passive. Chris also hit the nail on the head. Passive does not mean we don't do anything, as you'll see. A passive investment planner or financial planner, a wealth manager, whatever they're calling themselves, a passive person who you may hire is still doing things with your portfolio. But their passive approach, especially using model portfolios, allows them to hopefully charge you significantly lower fees than an active wealth manager or investment manager or investment advisor, financial planner, again, whatever they call themselves. Hopefully their fees are significantly lower than the active one. So if you're going to hire someone, ask them, how are you personally going to manage my portfolio? Are you active or passive? And the investments themselves you are going to use, are they active investments, passive investments, or a mixture? That's quite common. Some advisors will use a little bit of both. And to a small extent, we still use a few actively managed allocation funds, mostly in some of our very small positions or pie slices in our positioning portfolio, which we'll cover on a future show, probably show number 4 or 5. So anyways, I wanted to kind of explain some of that because that email did point out to me how we were missing that. I think we covered it well, but is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think that clarified all the related bits of that.
Okay. So how do we actually do what we do, and how do we create what we call our convenience portfolios? Again, this isn't rocket science. I was striving when I did this whole internal honest assessment of our firm after the 2008, early 2009 market correction. I told you we objectively looked at everything. We started evaluating. It took years, and it took hiring a CFA. And we walked through it. Listen to those previous two shows. But one of the elements I always wanted, Chris, was something that is simple to understand. I often say it's reasonable, it's understandable, it's defendable. All of the bubbles, if you will, that we wanted to cover so we could come up with something perfect, in our opinion, for distribution planning for retirees who are not getting younger, stronger, and healthier, but we're getting older and weaker, both physically, and I know so many listeners hate when I say this, mentally. We wanted something for distribution portfolios. The approach I'm going to describe is not, in my opinion, and I haven't adequately back-tested it or evaluated it or considered it, Chris, as an accumulation strategy. So do not rely on this for accumulation planning. You might like the idea. Do your own due diligence to see if it makes sense to you. I really evaluated it for a transitional person. In other words, someone generally in their mid-ish 50s, or in other words, somebody who's probably 3, 2, 1, maybe 5 or 8 years from retirement, somewhere in that period where you're not quite retired yet, but you don't really have a hell of a lot of time to recoup significant losses. You're not retired, but you're not accumulating. You transition. It's designed for transitional and distribution portfolios. That's how I evaluated it. There are other advisors listening to this show who might be nodding their heads, Chris, in agreement with us, and others who are screaming right now at their podcasting device that we're idiots and we don't know what we're doing. There is no right or wrong answer to managing portfolios. Chris, is financial planning, and by default, it's kissing cousin investment management. The two of those combined, is it an art, is it a science, or is it a little bit of both?
It's a bit of both. certainly has some scientific elements, some rules, some relationships that are fixed and known, or at least their interaction is understood and known. And there's other things where, you know, we have to admit that there's many paths to on the road to success as far as a successful plan goes. There's also many roads to failure. So it's not that there aren't bad roads to take. But I think understanding the reasonableness of the path that you're taking and keeping costs low as you go, you know, controlling what you can control is puts you a long way towards towards success. So, yeah, there's like you said, there's no one way of doing this, but we like our way. That's why we do it our way.
Well, I would hope we like our way by this point.
I don't want to undermine our way too much. I mean, we don't have to be that modest. It's we like it, and we think it makes sense, and most people we describe it to, not all, some prefer a different method, but most people we describe it to, it kind of resonates with them too.
Okay. So I just wanted all those caveats out there, especially, I think a lot of the do-it-yourselfers, especially you Vanguardians, will be nodding their head in approval and saying, okay, I understand what the guys are doing. I'm really kind of talking to the other advisors who listen to us. We are not throwing your approach under the bus. And I freely said on the very first show in this series, an accumulation planner may benefit from active management. I'm not saying yes or no. We don't specialize in accumulation planning. We're distribution planning. I personally believe in a distribution or transitional portfolio, passive on the financial planning side or investment advisor side you're working with, and passive on the actual investments within your portfolio makes the most sense. Okay, so what do we do? The first thing we wanted to do, to borrow from the previous show, and Chris, since you're much more pithy than me, I'm going to hit you with a question, see if you can nail it the first time.
Okay.
All right. What is one of our biggest pet peeves in investment management that we feel the industry purposefully ignores?
When we look around, the lack of benchmarking, I think, would be the number one pet peeve. That, and so our approach, we wanted to be able to do that effectively and benchmark and compare your actual portfolio that we're managing for you to a reasonable benchmark so you can judge the performance of that portfolio appropriately.
Exactly. And listen to prior podcasts, and I think podcast number 2 in this series, we cover that a little. Benchmarking, or the lack thereof, truly does bug me in the industry, because there's a lot of games being played, even with advisors who do benchmark or ostensibly say they're benchmarking. But those advisors who don't benchmark but tell you, okay, I'm managing your money moderately, which again, for us, it just so happens because we specialize in distribution planning and our clients are retirees, moderate seems to be the most preferred portfolio, that 60-40 mix of equities to fixed income. How do you know if you truly are delivering a moderate amount of risk? If you're a do-it-yourselfer, do you measure? Do you know if you truly have a moderate amount of risk? You might have 60-40 equities to fixed income, but are the components of that 60 and the components of that 40, have you really evaluated them and combined? Do they truly follow an impartial 60-40 mix? Are you looking at how correlated they are, how much volatility they have, how much risk they have? I don't know. But that is part of actively managed, but that is part of actively designing a risk-adjusted benchmark or a risk-adjusted portfolio. So the first thing we wanted to set out and do is say, okay, we are going to track target risk benchmark. If someone comes to me and says they want a moderate amount of risk, it's not just putting them in 60-40, because the 60% in equities, most advisors are going to be using ETFs. Very few actually buy individual equities. There are some out there, but if you only have a few $100,000 or even $1 million or so, it truly is kind of hard to really start taking positions in individual equities and individual fixed income and get adequate diversification, to get adequate exposure to different size equities, different classes of equities, different growth value, small cap, mid cap, consumer cyclicals, consumer non-cyclicals, all those types of things that you got to get. So it's much easier, Chris, to use exchange traded funds or mutual funds. You get much broader diversification. But have you actually looked to see if the 60% you have in equities are taking on much more risk than a traditional or quote unquote normal equity holding? That's what I'm getting at. So the first thing that we wanted to do was say, okay, we are going to use model portfolios because the investment advisor, us, we believe in passive. We wanted to follow a model. We wanted to keep our fee as low as humanly possible. So we went into model portfolios, and we wanted our models to follow the five standard levels of risk or volatility in the industry. Conservative being the least amount of risk, conservative, moderately conservative, moderate, which again is our most popular approach, and probably yours if you're listening to this and in your late 50s, 60s, early 70s, you're probably moderate. We're not saying you should be, and we're not giving specific investment advice to anyone listening to this. I'm just saying you might be moderate yourself. Then there's moderately aggressive and aggressive. So those are the five levels of risk. So we wanted to say, or I said when I started developing this, look, we are going to come up with just five models, and we are going to track target risk benchmarks. So if somebody says to us, we want a moderate amount of risk, I want to be able to show them that's what we're doing. So we decided to use a third-party provider, and we chose Morningstar. And Morningstar has what they call their target risk benchmarks.
They don't call them that technically. They're called target risk allocation.
The target risk allocations, mm-hmm. but they're only available in target risk benchmarks. You cannot buy these from Morningstar.
They are benchmarks. If someone is looking for them, Morningstar doesn't call them benchmarks. They're called Morningstar target risk allocations.
Okay. Concede that. We use them as benchmarks, right. And they're often available in software to us specifically as benchmarks,
right.
Not investments.
Right.
So as Travis, the CFA who does all of this with us, he often says they are theoretical. They don't exist in the real world.
Right.
They pay no investment management fees. They pay no taxes. Here's the kicker. They're rebalanced daily. So they are not reasonable ways for someone to go out and actually try to even replicate them. You're not going to rebalance something daily. It's just nuts. So they are used for measuring purposes. But why did I want to do this? Because I wanted and valued, we may sometimes throw quote unquote Wall Street under the bus. I wouldn't consider Morningstar a member of Wall Street. They don't broker or deal securities. They don't make transactional profits. They're not a Wall Street firm. They rate, analyze, and give their opinions of Wall Street firms. They probably piss off a lot of Wall Street firms when they rate some of their investments. So that's why we chose Morningstar. I've been using them for years. This is not an endorsement of them. I just want people to understand, why did I choose their allocations when nearly every major Wall Street firm, Chris, and independent ratings companies similar to Morningstar, or research companies they call them, also provide benchmarks or allocations, as you rightly pointed out. There's many out there. I just used Morningstar because I knew them. I have faith in them. I've been using them for a while. So that's why. You could use any of your choosing if they make sense to you. But a target risk allocation, Morningstar designed these specifically, Chris, and they put it right in their name, target risk. They are trying to use these in the industry to say, hey, if you want to measure what you're doing and the particular person you're managing money for specified they wanted a moderately conservative amount of risk. This is our opinion of what that should look like. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense, Chris?
Yeah, and by opinion, just so people can have a little more clarity here, they have a very specific allocation of not just the broad classes of stocks versus bonds versus cash, maybe. Those are, you know, very broad. But within that, they break it down into individually more specific asset allocations. Things like a certain amount of mid-cap growth stocks versus non-US REITs and things, you know, so they get a little more specificity, which allows us to build the model portfolios to mimic as close as possible or replicate these target risk allocations that are defined not by us, but by those third-party wizards, if you will, at Morningstar.
So that's perfect, Chris. That's exactly what we were trying to do. So we just chose to utilize Morningstar. It does not mean you do-it-yourselfers need to do that. Use whoever you're comfortable with. So that's the first thing we did. So we decided that we were going to use Morningstar. Then, because we subscribe to their services, we get access to the 21 different allocations, if you will, or asset classes within each of those target risk portfolios or benchmarks that Morningstar has: conservative, moderate, moderately aggressive, and aggressive. They have 21 asset classes that comprise each portfolio at different allocations to all those 21. And as you play or as they adjust the allocation, Chris, to those 21 asset classes, they can adjust the volatility or their analysts' opinion of the volatility that each of those target risk portfolios should have. So a conservative portfolio has the standard, listeners, 20% stocks. In Morningstar's opinion, 73% fixed income, 5% inflation hedge, and 2% cash. On the other extreme, their aggressive portfolio or allocation, as Chris rightly pointed out, has 95% stocks, just 5% fixed income, and no inflation hedge and no cash. And the three portfolios sandwiched between those two, Chris, have different breakdowns as well. Mm-hmm. Then within the stocks, bonds, inflation hedge, not cash, cash is just cash. Within those three broad classes are individual asset classes. So it gets a little more interesting. The inflation hedge has three different asset classes. The bonds have five different asset classes. And the stocks, I actually have to count those as so many different ones. One, two, three.
It's about 15 or so.
15, yep. Mm-hmm. 15 different stock asset classes. And all of those are in different proportions as well. Mm-hmm. So Morningstar does a lot of deep research. And that was another thing that attracted me to this approach and to electing these target risk portfolios. They are well diversified across the broad asset classes and the broad asset classes would be stocks, bonds, inflation, hedges, and cash. And then within those broad asset classes, all the different individual assets that comprise them are the ones that are well diversified. That's what I wanted to say. I didn't say it too well at first. So that's the first thing we did. So we decided to use those. Then we went out, when I say we, the chartered financial analyst, Travis, the gentleman that I hired, he then had to go out and research, Chris, and in his opinion, find the publicly traded, exchange-traded funds, passively managed exchange-traded funds that, in his opinion, best matched each asset class. And that, folks, was not nearly as easy as it sounds.
Right. Some of those narrower asset classes are pretty easy to replicate with ETFs. There's lots of ETFs that focus on that. For instance, large cap growth stocks is an example of one of these classes. There's lots of those to choose from in the ETF world. But non-U.S. stocks, non-U.S. REITs, for instance, that's technically one of these little asset classes inside here, and that's going to be a much narrower family out in the ETF world. So he had to do a fair amount of research to try to, again, what we're trying to do is replicate these target risk allocations, because we can't go to Morningstar and buy these. This isn't something they're selling. They provide this information, sell this information to subscribers, etc. So they're providing all this research information, but they're not providing the mechanism to actually invest in these things. That's what has to be done through these model portfolios built with the ETFs that Jim's talking about.
And they have not licensed the use for someone to go out and replicate these either on Wall Street. So there's no active or even passively managed ETF designed to do this. So again, they were created as benchmarks, as measuring tools for investment advisors to use. That's what they were designed for. The difficulty that Travis has and continues to have is Morningstar will not disclose the individual investments that their analysts track for each asset class. Mm-hmm. They will not disclose that. They feel it is proprietary, and they are correct, Chris. It is proprietary, and they shouldn't disclose it. I mean, if they want to stay profitable. So they don't disclose that. And it's not easy to just go out and find ETFs that do this. Because Travis and we as a firm on our due diligence side, we have to delve deeply into the numbers behind everything and start to see if these portfolios are truly tracking, if there's deviation. There is always going to be deviation, listeners, because remember, any type of measuring you're trying to follow, any type of measuring benchmark you're trying to follow is theoretical. It doesn't exist in the real world. There are no trading costs. There's no custodial fees. There's no advisory fees. There's no taxes. It's rebalanced daily. All of these things can happen in the theoretical world, but not in the real world. And that's where it gets difficult to actually track this benchmark. I thought it was going to be a lot easier than it has. I'm glad we outsource it to Travis because it would take us a lot of time to do it. So if you're a do-it-yourselfer out there, it's not quite as easy as it sounds, but it can be done. But that's how we do it. So once Travis did his research and we have our list of ETFs, the next step that we do is we begin. We're not going to get into the whole suitability review. Generally speaking, we work with people who are financial planning clients of ours if we're managing their assets. If they're not financial planning clients of ours, and we do have a lot who aren't as well, we will have to now walk them through suitability. I'm not going to get into that, but we would walk them through suitability reviews, try to make sure that whichever model they choose is appropriate, Chris, for their particular situation. So let's just assume that was already done. Once we have that set, whether it's one of our financial planning clients or a investment-only client, and we know exactly what we're going to put them in, we will then purchase the individual ETFs within their portfolio, obviously, and put them in our due diligence review. And that's where we start getting deeper behind the scenes. So one of the things that you will do if you're doing this yourself is look, and you should look every month at the performance of the ETFs. How are they tracking relative to the benchmark that you're trying to mimic, relative to their peers out in Wall Street world, if you will? Each of these asset classes, Chris, the 21 different individual asset classes within those broad categories have hundreds of ETFs in their category, hundreds. Well, you can get what the average of all of those have been performing, again, through software. We use Morningstar, but you can use others. So we can see, Chris, each month, how is the ETF we're doing relative to its peers. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So we track that every month, and we look not just to see if the performance is the best. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking to make sure relative to their peers and relative to the Morningstar class that it is comprised of, our chosen ETF is following on some different levels. So we look at the ETFs individually and we look at the portfolio as a whole. And what are we looking at? We're looking not just at return. And I think that surprises a lot of do-it-yourselfers, because I think you would agree, Chris, most individual do-it-yourselfers fixate on just return.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly worthy of attention and pay, you know, tracking that. But that's only part of the whole story to investing, right? The whole, what we talk all the time about, the risk-return trade-off or risk-return relationship. There's that risk component in there as well, which can, you know, be revealed in a number of different aspects. There's lots of parts to risk, but yeah, fixating just on return, you might not be understanding the whole story quite as well as you should.
So we look every month, we compile the data every quarter. So we don't every month sit there and analyze each different ETF. We collect the data monthly. We analyze it quarterly. And again, when I say we, don't think Chris and I are doing this. We hired it out. Our firm is, again, at the size where that just makes far more sense for us. If you're a smaller investment manager or new to the industry, you might be doing this all yourself, similar to the way I was doing 20 years ago. If you're a do-it-yourselfer Vanguardian listening to this, you probably do some of this already. I don't know. If you don't, you should start. But you may decide to do it monthly just because you're wicked into it. Or you may decide to do it quarterly, semi-annually, or annually. But we look at all types of different measures. I'll just give you a few. And this is on the due diligence side of what we do. My firm has adopted what I call, Chris, the DAD approach to managing portfolios: due diligence, administration, and design. DAD, DAD. I already went over the design. I led with that, how we came about this. We'll get into the administrative, the A, later. Right now, I'm on the last D, due diligence. So there's the design, and we reviewed that. There's the administration. I'll get to that in a second. And then there is the due diligence. The due diligence, Chris, is the most work.
Yeah.
It's the single biggest element of our fee. When we talk about fees, we break it out so you'll know what you're paying for. It's the single biggest part of our fee because it's a lot of work on the due diligence. So some of the things we look at and analyze, of course, the organization of the ETF. We want to make sure the firm we are using is well established. There's nothing negative about them going on. They're sticking to their investment mandate. So we look at the organization. We obviously look at expenses. We compare the expenses to the industry average and to that particular category of ETFs and asset class. So we try to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So we look at expenses. We look at the asset base of the ETF. Is it getting too big? Really, really big? That generally on a passively managed ETF is not an issue. We'll spend more time for the very few actively managed mutual funds, Chris, that we still utilize occasionally. The asset base really applies to them. But that is part of our due diligence, the asset base. Style consistency has to be one of the most important things that Travis is looking for. I won't name the particular ETFs, Chris, and you don't do this, Chris, so this might be news to you as well. You handle the upstairs, we call it. He does the financial planning. Investment management is done downstairs in our office. Style consistency, Chris, we have several ETFs, I don't want to say on the chopping block, but they are under the microscope because they changed their investment mandate last year, Chris.
Hmm.
And Travis is like, well, wait a minute. This isn't quite what we wanted. And we're watching them.
Right. And that's important to understand that if you're doing this yourself, just because maybe you put a ton of research into it and you build this portfolio you're very proud of, you can't just leave it be. You know, certainly if you're investing in individual securities, it's a little different story, although you've got to monitor those because those companies are going to change what they're doing. And just because on one day you liked them, 2 years later, you may not. Same thing's going to apply to these funds. Funds do evolve and change the way they behave and act, and the mandate and their goals can change. And you've got to be up on this. That's where the due diligence comes in. If someone's not watching it for you, you need to watch it yourself, because that portfolio you designed 5 years ago, you're very proud of, through no changes of your own, might have changed without you noticing. And that's important to track.
And it's very important because style consistency, mm-hmm. which kind of goes hand in hand to another category we track, philosophy and process. You got to understand one thing about Wall Street folks. They know most people will purchase an investment based on performance only. Well, gee, I have to buy mid-cap U.S. value. So they'll generate a report, they'll research online, top 10 mid-cap U.S. value, and they just sift through them. They might choose performance as the number one thing, and they'll look and they'll say, oh, wow, this one made a 10.9, and the next closest only made 9.4, and everyone else is below them. I'm going with the 10.9. That's how a lot of people do it, and Wall Street knows that. So sometimes they change style, consistency, and philosophy because they're chasing performance. And that was the big thing that we noticed, the funds, the ETFs that we were using. And I said that to Travis when he reviewed this with me. I said, they're chasing performance. I knew exactly what they're doing, and they are, in my opinion. So we constantly have to watch this. This is the due diligence part. If you're managing your own money, you should be doing this. If you're hiring an investment advisor, ask them to please explain what are they going to be doing every month and every quarter for the fee you are paying them. So anyway, so these are all the things we look at the individual level, Chris, of the actual components, if you will, of our model portfolios. And there's one other aspect I didn't review, the manager. We want to make sure the manager or manager team stays consistent. If it changes, we don't necessarily leave, especially on a passively managed investment. If the investment is trying to track, Chris, an index or their own benchmark, and the manager team changes, but they're not changing the philosophy and style consistency, we're much more receptive to keeping them. We're going to put them on a watch list. But if a manager changes, we have to put our red flag up, if you will, looking next for a philosophy or consistency change, because it's more common. It's just like the Las Vegas Raiders. The Raiders just stole Josh McDaniels, the Patriots offensive coordinator, as their new head coach. I think the players are now saying, oh, we're most likely going to have a different offense, maybe a different defensive approach. Things are going to change. There's a new head honcho. Not only can that happen to a football team, folks, it can happen to an investment. So that's what we look at on the individual investment side. Does that make sense, Chris?
Yes, it does.
Now, all of those individual investments are held, folks, again, in different percentages in each of the five model portfolios. So now we have to compare the real world to the theoretical world. What do I mean by that? Every quarter, we take all of that individual data that we've comprised over the past 3 months, we put it together into the actual investment performance. We track all of this in special software that we have access to. You do-it-yourselfers, I'm not quite sure how you're going to do this. You might not have access to a lot of what we have access to. But now we start to look at the benchmark performance over that quarter, Chris, to the actual performance of the investments. Follow me so far?
Yep, I think it makes sense.
And at that level, we're looking at different elements. We're looking at the standard deviation of our group of ETFs relative to the target risk Morningstar allocation, or what we call benchmark. So standard deviation is volatility. If you don't understand what standard deviation is, Google it and learn. It goes well beyond the scope of today's show. But I'm just trying to give you do-it-yourselfers an idea of what you should be looking at quarterly. Told you what you should look at monthly at the actual ETF levels. Put it all together and compare your performance each quarter to the performance of the benchmark you are trying to track. But what you're going to look at there, because the benchmark cannot be invested in, it's theoretical. So what you're going to look at there are more statistical measures. Volatility, as measured by standard deviation. You want to make sure you're within a certain range of tolerance. We look for about 8, 5, 8, sometimes 10% sway, if you will, between the two. We want to make sure we're very, very close relative to the standard deviation. You're also going to look at the R squared. R squared is just the easiest way to think of it, correlation. If your model portfolio, listeners, is zigging, but the benchmark is zagging, do you think you have a high R squared, Chris, or a low R squared?
That would be low when they're going opposite directions, for sure.
Absolutely. R squared is a statistical measure to take a portfolio compared to whatever you're trying to track and let you know, is it zigging when it's zigging? Is it zagging when it's zagging? The highest R squared you can have is 100. That means you're doing exactly what the benchmark is doing. But if your R squared is coming in at,
well, it's technically
80,
one. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about in percentages, but yeah.
You were all broken up. I couldn't hear you.
You're talking in percentages for those following out there. So biggest R squared is one, which you can also call 100.
I've always tracked R squared up to 100.
Yeah.
Beta, I'll track up to one, but R squared, I'll track, it's 100. So you can be 100. Most of our models come in at 99 point something, and that's what we strive for. If you are doing this, you need to be comparing what you are managing to the R squared, or correlation of what you're trying to track. Or if you've hired someone, you should be asking them, can you show me the correlation of what you're doing to, hopefully they're benchmarking you and they're not just looking at performance. Oh, look at the XYZ benchmark that I'm trying to track. It came in at 10 and you got 11.4. Don't pat the guy or gal on the back and say, great job. That should throw up a little bit of a red flag to you and say, well, wait a minute. I'm significantly ahead. That's like a 10% greater return than what you're trying to track. What's my R squared? What's the correlation relative to that benchmark? What's the volatility? What's the risk? Are you actually taking on more risk and delivering that greater return? That's something that you want to know, and that's what we track. R squared is very important to us, and we can break the R squared out for a 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 7 year, 10 year period. So it allows us to look and see and make sure what we're trying to do is closely correlated to the benchmark. So that's what we do on a quarterly level. That's what you do-it-yourselfers should be doing. And if you are paying someone to do this for you, I just can't see working with an investment advisor who's not going to show you things like this. So ask them for it. Okay. So we look at standard deviation of volatility. We look at R squared, or correlation. And we look at beta. Beta is a measure of risk. Beta is simply telling you, do you have more risk or less risk than a given benchmark that you are trying to track? And a benchmark can be anything that you set the analysis software to. So we set it obviously to the Morningstar target risk allocations. But if you are comparing yourself to a mutual fund or an ETF or to your own custom benchmark, you can program the analysis software that you're using to replicate that. And then the analysis will show you if you are taking on more risk. And to me, Chris, this is the most important element. And it's what worries me a lot out there. If you are a do-it-yourselfer, you might be taking on more risk than you think. You might have 60% equities, 40% fixed income. But if you aren't looking at the individual investments and what they're doing and taking all of the R squared and standard deviation and correlation and beta of each individual investment, weighting it. That's what the software, the analysis software of a portfolio will do for you. It will then weight this particular investment represents 18.9% of your portfolio. I'm just making that up. And it has a volatility of this relative to the benchmark and a beta of this. And it's just going to come up with the weighted average of all the different investments that you have, folks, and give you the stated number. We look at this quarterly with beta being one of the most important, because if somebody wants and says to us, I don't want more than a moderate amount of risk, but we're managing the portfolio, Chris, and it has a moderately aggressive amount of risk, but I'm telling the client it's moderate, we're not doing, in my opinion, our fiduciary duty. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Totally.
Did you want to expand on that? Or are you good to go?
Oh, that's. I totally agree.
All right. Yeah. You totally agree.
Totally agree.
Okay. So again, folks, there's things that we do on the due diligence side monthly, and you're going to set your own. There's no right or wrong answer. When I talk to colleagues about this, some will tell me, well, we look at this, 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 and this every month. And I say, well, here's the things that are important to us, and we look at that. There's no right or wrong answer. Now, a CFA might say, well, you always have to look at this, this, and this. And that's what we rely on Travis for. He's given us the definitives he wants us to look at. And then we come up, or I came up with others that I want to track. So you look at each individual investment, and then you look at the performance of all of those individual investments together in your portfolio. And on, again, the quarterly reviews, where we look at the actual portfolio performance, we're looking at beta, we look at standard deviation, and we look at R squared. We'll also look at the historical mean. The mean is the return of the benchmark relative to the investment portfolio. So we'll look at that as well. And we're making sure they stay within our stated tolerances. So that's the due diligence. And that's really the meat and potatoes. You can do it yourself. We just gave away a soup recipe, you know, from the Soup Nazi when Elaine found the Soup Nazi's recipes and put them out of business. So maybe we just put ourselves out of business. I don't know. We gave away the secret, or it's not even a secret. I tried to explain to you why we do it, and this is how we do it. The how is not nearly as involved. If we were active managers and we had come up with our own measures, remember when I shared, Chris, to the listeners, and you knew this because you were working with me, that was my initial approach. I was going to use that course satellite, and I hired Travis originally to help me come up with the measures that we were going to analyze each month and quarter to decide if we should actively move into this sector and that sector. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot more involved, and it can often justify. I admit it's a hell of a lot of work, and it could be why your advisor charges 1.3, 1.5, 1.9, or whatever it is they may be charging. If they're charging a lot more than the standard 1%, they may very well be doing an awful lot of additional work. And it can help explain, I don't want to say justify, but it can help explain their fee. We chose, again, the opposite. we wanted to keep this as low cost as possible. Because when all of this blew up in 2008, I had to look objectively, like I told you. I had to look at the performance of the funds, but I also had to look and say, okay, what else is causing a negative return to my client portfolios? It wasn't just Wall Street. What else was taking money from my client portfolios, Chris?
Well, the easiest one, I'll say, is to understand at least, are the fees. I mean, there's the Wall Street rate of return performance, which is moving forward unpredictable. You know, it's hard to understand why there's outperformance or underperformance, we would call it. But you can point to a fee and say, you know, if this was smaller, we'd be better off. I mean, that's the nice thing about attacking something like fees, or I oftentimes compare it to tax planning. When you can point to a number and say, we've reduced this number right here for your benefit, that's a lot easier to understand and a direct benefit, if you will, that's observable. And the fees are that for your portfolio. Reducing those fees are a direct benefit to your portfolio performance.
Exactly. So we're going to get into fees on the next show, and I'll explain how I attacked those. What we've been really talking about for these first three shows is the process of which took what made me evolve from a totally active on the way I manage portfolios and active of the elements I used in my client portfolios. I was an active, how I transformed to a passive. And again, it is designed, in my opinion, for distribution portfolios. By having model portfolios and utilizing passively managed low-cost exchange-traded funds, and of course, having access to the wonderful analysis, performance reporting, internal analysis that we have to come up with all these numbers, as well as trading, we can easily, with the software that we use, I don't know if individual investors have as robust on a custodian's platform as we do. I doubt it, but they may. I'm not an individual investor on those platforms, Chris. But we can, if a client came to us and said, we need $30,000 from our brokerage account, if they're in one of our models, we can use all the information in the software to tell us what individual shares, what individual lots can free up that $30,000 on with the lowest amount of embedded taxes. Or if taxes aren't an issue, if we're inside an IRA, we can just do a rebalance, if you will. We can rebalance right into the portfolio. And when it's all said and done, when the smoke clears, have the $30,000 available. We can do that very easily. And it's one reason we wanted to go with the passively managed models. It's going to be very easy and has been a lot easier for our clients to understand and for their assets to be managed on a distribution, because there's always negative cash flows coming out of those portfolios. So that's, again, how we do it. It's why we do it. I think we covered everything, Chris. Is there anything else you feel should go over?
I think we drew a pretty good picture, and people will let us know if we need to fill in a few gaps or clarify anything. So reach out.
Yeah. I can already, when you said people will let us know, you're probably wondering how often do we rebalance? That's under the design part. It's not really a due diligence side. Remember, we use DAD. I call it DAD. I created that acronym. Design, administration, and due diligence. As part of our design, we had to also come up and decide how often are we going to rebalance. So we decided to rebalance every 6 months. Obviously, daily, which is what the benchmarks do, is impossible.
We're
not going to do it. If you want to rebalance daily, go ahead. It's asinine. We don't rebalance daily, and we never would. We have found rebalancing every 6 months works perfectly. So we will rebalance portfolios every 6 months. That is done automatically. It's, again, part of the service you get in the convenience portfolios. And then unique to the benchmarks that we have chosen to follow, Morningstar changes their allocation percentages every June. So every June, we're watching, we're waiting for the new allocation percentages to come out. Occasionally, they add a new asset class like they did, I want to say, 5, 6, 7 years ago now. They added emerging markets to their repertoire, if you will. So we had to go out, do some more research and add emerging markets. So sometimes they make major changes like that, Chris. Other times it's more tweaking. Mm-hmm. Their analysts are saying, in light of things that are going on in the economy or things going on in the valuation of the different markets or whatever elements they're analyzing and taking into consideration, they'll say, we are now going to change the allocation to this asset and that asset and this one. We're changing them. And they do. They tweak it. So we reprogram everything into our system. We will time that with one of our rebalances. So when we rebalance, it's usually the second rebalance of the year, it will also capture those Morningstar changes and allows us to continue to closely track the allocation that we're trying to follow. So I did, I when you said you can get a hold of us if you have a question, I just anticipated that question.
Right.
How often do you guys rebalance? And then the final thing, and I believe every investment advisor out there offers this, it's the A, it's the administration. One of the advantages would be that, you know, we do all the work. If you want to convert, if you want to recharacterize, not a conversion because you can't recharacterize those, but if you want to recharacterize a contribution, if you want to change beneficiaries, whatever the case may be, obviously we do that. So it's a smaller part of the actual convenience portfolio. The design and the due diligence, the two D's, is the lion's share of what we do. The A in the middle, the administration, that's truly the convenience, Chris. Hey, I want to do this. Well, let me just call the firm and let them do it. Hey, we want to change the beneficiary. Can you get that done? Sure, we'll take care of that. So that's the administrative part also. All of this goes into our fee structure, which we'll go over next week with you all. If you are a do-it-yourselfer, I hope you got a little bit of an idea, maybe a way to look at your portfolios. It's totally up to you. If you are an active do-it-yourselfer or a passive do-it-yourselfer, you should look to try to make sure, if you think you designed a moderate portfolio, make sure you truly do have a moderate portfolio. It's not just saying I have 60% equities and 40% fixed income. Start looking at all of those and the return that that portfolio has created. You got to compare it to whatever benchmark you think is reasonable for you. And then look at the correlation or R squared. Look at the standard deviation. Look at the beta. Try to get an idea if you are actually truly tracking what you are trying to do. Don't just look at 60-40. That's too broad. You got to look at everything together, and you have to compare it to something. Or there's no way of saying you truly have a moderate portfolio. You might have 60-40 stocks to bonds, but what if your bonds are all ultra short-term bonds, or worse, long-term government bonds, or corporate bonds, or junk bonds? You may have 60-40, but you have 40%, especially if they're 40% to junk bonds, you have 40%, Chris, that's way more volatile than most fixed income.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have 60-40 and consider yourself moderate, but from a volatility standpoint and a beta standpoint, you're off the chart. That's why you need to have something to measure your performance to. So if you are managing your own money, you need to be doing this. If you're working with an advisor, ask them to please, hey, I told you I wanted moderately conservative. Can you please tell me and show me that's what I am, or moderate, or conservative, or moderately aggressive, whatever you may be. They have to be comparing it to something. Okay, I think that covers everything that I wanted to go over today.
Yeah, I think that got us set up nicely for next time to dive into the fees, which if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you know, your fee is your time and effort. If you're going to have someone like us do it, we're going to share with you how we, you know, structure our fees to provide what Jim just described here in this show. All these things that we would do as part of that asset management service, what does it really cost? And we'll talk about that. And there's some variables, right? Not everyone is the same cost, but it's very clear, as you'll see next time, in the way we approach this to determine what are the things that affect your costs. And we believe they make sense, right? They're understandable. You can point to them and say, okay, I understand why there's that fee. I understand why there's this charge over here. And we'll look forward to sharing that with you next time.
Perfect.
So thanks for joining me again, Jim, and thanks for everybody else listening. We'll we've got at least one more show, maybe two, because after we do fees, we're going to talk a little bit about this concept of positioning, which kind of takes the portfolio management to another level for those that need that type of extra portfolio attention, we'll call it. But we'll talk about those two things. I suspect that'll take two shows. So once again, we're going to be in a five-show series like we did 2 years ago. I thought we were going to get through asset management a little bit quicker, but
yeah, I thought
it is what it is.
Yeah, I thought it might have been four, but yeah, it's going
to
be five.
Yeah, I think so too. So we'll look forward to talking to everybody again next week with part four.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.